CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, we're on SoundCloud and Facebook, so check us out. Joining us in the studio is Linda McQuaig, and she's the author of a brand new book, The Sport and Prey of Capitalists, How the Rich Are Stealing Canada's Public Wealth. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming
in. Nice to be here.
You've written a lot of great books. You have, everybody knows you have a gift for titles, which is, to me, it's kind of like headlines.
No, it's important.
You better get that headline. A lot of writers are miserable, but somebody puts a dumb headline on a really good article.
Yeah.
This book is a loan from a friend, and I have to tell you, I tend to underline what I'm going to do in an interview. I would have underlined most of the book, so it's that kind of book. It's
okay,
got a lot of great content. In a way, you could call it, and one of the views I got from it is it's a back to the future, because you tell us about Canadian history, and I have to tell you, I thought I knew it, but thank goodness you have taken it up, because we're talking about the old issue of privatization, the marketplace, versus the issue of, well, public ownership and government and democratic control of our institutions. And I'll start with this, because to contemporize it, we have an election coming up. You pointed out that in the last election, Justin Trudeau picked up a whiff of a desire on the part of the Canadian people to once again have an assertion of sovereignty or domination of the society by an elected government. And he talked about building infrastructure. And it would seem to be, everybody agreed, a very smart political move, just at a time when his social democratic opponents started talking about fiscal responsibility. This is a brilliant first chapter. But so he got elected, telling the people, all right, we're going to build infrastructure for you, schools, whatever. And then he went to Davos and he met a man named Fink. So tell us about, who is this guy Fink? And, you know, it's bothersome to people. You say that it hasn't been reported. I didn't know about it till I read your book. So he was headed in one direction, but then he went in another.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of interesting the way he did that turnaround. Okay, Larry Fink, you raise him. He is, well, Forbes magazine has called him the 34th most powerful man in the world. So you get a sense you're dealing with big power there. He's a Wall Street guy. He heads up BlackRock Investing, which is the biggest investment firm on Wall Street or in the world, with more than $5 trillion in assets to invest. So we're talking big, big Wall Street player. Just to back up, you were saying, it's true. Trudeau ran in the 2015 election. One of his key campaign promises was that he would invest in lots of public infrastructure that Canada, everybody agrees, we need more transit and housing and all that stuff. So it sounded like a good promise. And he always couched it in terms of, you know, this would be, we should take advantage of these really, really low interest rates, historic low interest rates, and so we can do all this investment and we can support our municipalities. It sounds so public, right?
Yes.
But what he ends up doing is, after the election, he goes over to Davos and, as you say, meets up with this guy, Larry Fink. Now, I don't think it was just totally accidental.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say, the 34th most powerful guy probably can arrange for a prime minister to meet him.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of middlemen that I talk about in the book.
Yes.
Dominic Barton, who's now going to be our ambassador to China, etc. And basically what ends up happening is that all this notion of this great public investment to rebuild our infrastructure at low cost is just out the window. Because now the new plan, now the election is over, and it's not really publicly announced, but this is what ends up happening behind the scenes, is that the, you know, Larry Fink and other big Wall Street investors and institutional investors basically get the Trudeau government to involve them in this infrastructure scheme. And that changes the whole picture, because we go from a very low-cost public investment infrastructure mm-hmm. to very, very inflated high costs, and where these guys, these private investors will end up owning big chunks of our infrastructure. It's a terrible deal. It's not
out of the kindness of their hearts.
Yeah, and it's always sold to us. It's always sold to us by guys like Trudeau, well, or Bill Morneau, the finance minister. It's always sold to us, well, this way it will free up, we won't have to spend our tax dollars on infrastructure, so we can save those tax dollars and spend them on, you know, things that are important, like social housing and public transit. What kind of planet do they, were we born yesterday? Where, if we don't get that money from our tax dollars, where do we think we're going to get? We're going to get it from those private Wall Street guys, and they're going to give it to us for free? Yes. I mean, it's ludicrous. Obviously, they're going to charge us an arm and a leg.
Yes. But that is so, again, well, you know, and if we could, if we had the missing piece in this, that is the Davos conversation, if we'd all been in on that conversation, even including some of our elected people, maybe they would have been on their hind legs saying, well, tell us more about that conversation. What do we get? How much do we put in, and how much does he make off us?
Yeah, it's very clear from even what we know in the public record that they end up, that his company, BlackRock, ends up advising.
There's all these evil names. Bad day at BlackRock comes to mind.
You know, advising the very top levels within the PMO, you know, so about how to structure this infrastructure bank. Then on top of that, you got all these private sector businessmen and private institutional investors who Morneau appoints as his Council of Economic Advisors, who end up proposing exactly what BlackRock wants to sell, and yeah. exactly what will reward them too financially.
Yes.
It's such a
room full of people, and one of them says, "I agree with the most wealthy man in the room." You think, well, there might be some money in that.
No, and it's such a scam, and then they try and sell it to us, and the media buys into it.
Yeah.
I quote all these different people in the media who sort of say, "Oh, well, we better, you know, this is a great opportunity. You know, we better get on board with this."
Well, you point out, you're dealing with what actually, since Ronald Reagan, has sort of been the mantra, which is, you got to free the market, let the market take over. Self-regulation, which, of course, we're hearing even more loudly than ever from Trump, and the idea that only private sector people know how to do things.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like privatization, my whole book is basically the story of privatization. And when you think about it, all it is the doctrine, you know, that the private sector always does things better. So government should get out of the way and let the private sector own things and run things, and, you know, that'll be the perfect world.
Because they're creative.
But what I find so interesting is that it's always asserted with great confidence by the business community, all these privatization advocates, you know, private sector always does things better. It's asserted with great confidence, but never with any evidence. In fact, there's no evidence that you know, that they do anything, that they always do things better. They do some things better, some things worse. And overall, the evidence is it's very costly when we turn to them, when we privatize things and hand things over to them. It ends up costing us a fortune.
Yeah.
I mean, I give the example. I mean, my favorite example is the 407.
Yes, please talk about that.
Okay,
yes, and end with telling me how in the world it ended up that it's a Spanish private outfit that has it for 99 years or something.
Yes,
that's almost, as the song said, that's almost for life.
It's for, I would venture to say it's probably for the lifetime of just about, well, everybody in this room, you and me, and probably everybody listening.
Yes.
You know, that's a long time. But anyway, the 407 is a highway, you know, that was built in the 90s to relieve traffic gridlock in the Toronto area, which is terrible. When it was built, it was built by the Bob Ray government. It was built, it had tolls attached to it. And there was a reason for that, to pay, you know, the Ray government did that to pay for the construction costs. And the argument was, the promise was, as soon as the construction costs were paid for, that the tolls would be removed. What ends up happening is Mike Harris's conservative government comes in all gangbusters in favor of privatization, and they sell the 407, terrible deal, sell it for $3 billion. It's now worth more than $30 billion, but that's not even the worst part of the deal. The worst part is the privatization. Privatization is often like a 30-year lease. They signed a 99-year lease with this private foreign consortium based in Spain. Mm-hmm. And not only is it long, but there's no protections against the private company raising the tolls. So surprise, surprise, they just keep raising the tolls, and it's cost us billions.
Well, that'll keep the poor people off the highway.
Well, we shouldn't laugh.
Would be an obvious fact, wouldn't it? I mean, that's one of the things that's going to happen.
I mean, that's one of the points I raised, just how in terms of public policy, this is just so, we have a road that's been paid for by the public, by a lot of it through tax dollars, and the low-income people can't pause. It's probably the most expensive toll road in the world. But so,
well, at least it's owned by Spaniards.
If it had remained public, by now the tolls would have paid for the construction. The road would be free, or we could decide to keep the tolls and direct them to something we really need, like public transit. Yeah. Instead,
I'm really surprised at how you could have a project that big that a following government could just take it apart.
Well, are you talking about?
You mean when they undertook to establish to build the 407, I'm amazed that anybody could come in and say, "Well, we're going to just
The government's have the power to privatize it." Oh, but are you saying why can't a government reverse that now?
Well, I hope they can.
The Harris government signed an airtight deal. The McGuinty government tried to get them to change it so that they could have some control over the tolls, and they failed in court. Now, I'm not saying that you couldn't do it. They should just forget the courts, just expropriate the highway.
Well, they take it from us. Why can't we take it from them?
Absolutely. I think we can. Instead, we are going to go on paying ever higher tolls to this foreign company for the next 8 decades.
Yes. Yike, it's a good word for you. We're speaking to Linda McQuaig, and she has a wonderful book titled The Sport and Prey of Capitalists. A great line comes out of the mouth of a capitalist, which I wish we had capitalists that talk the way that one did.
Well, that was the Premier of Ontario in 1905.
I guess, what was it, the Bolsheviks told everybody, after them we can't use the word anymore? Or is it? Well, now look, you do tell history in a way that, I call it Back to the Future. We have myths about our origins and the origins of Canadian CNR, CPR, Ontario Hydro. What a great story. Mr. Adam Beck, now I'm going to take my hat off every time I go by a statue. You have sold me. What's the title? From Berlin to, Niagara Falls and Berlin Rises. Tell us what happened there.
Okay. I mean, let me just make the point that, you know, that we have tremendous public enterprise, a history of tremendous public enterprise in this country. And one of the great ones, I was going to say was Ontario Hydro, because it's now been privatized. But starts out with a fierce battle in the 1890s for control of Niagara Falls, because the technologies developed to be able to harness that water power and transmit it over fairly long distances. So there's a fierce competition that develops between private interests led by the syndicate, which is headed by this guy, Henry Pellet, who ends up...
Oh, yes, I forget. I left out the villain.
Yeah, he, the villain, there you go.
King of Castle Loma.
Well, he wanted to live like a king, so he built himself a castle.
And waited for us to pay for it.
But what... Okay, so against him, and he's a real powerful player, and he's got partners in the syndicate, against them rise up a popular movement in the 1890s, based on eventually thousands of ordinary citizens, small business people, civic politicians, and they have a very different vision of what should happen to Niagara Falls. What they want is public power. They want public control over Niagara Falls, and they want that transmitted into electricity for the benefit of the public. And they organize an unbelievable movement that goes on for over a decade.
The mayor of Berlin, eh?
Well, so that it eventually...
Kitzinger, pardon me. London.
What ends up happening is, Adam Beck is one of the heroes of this story. He was the mayor of London, and he gets elected to the legislature, becomes a real champion of this public power movement. And he's within the... Eventually, the conservatives that he's a part of. He's a conservative, let's not forget that, which is pretty interesting.
You know, I love that about your book. It's so many times people who stood up for the people were actually Conservative Party
people.
Well,
you know what's so interesting is that the old notion of conservatism actually included the idea of, you know, genuinely defending
public service
public-spirited
citizens,
the public good, you know.
Yes.
I mean, let's not get carried away too much. These guys were pretty elitist as well. But they did, like, James...
Well, turning on the lights for the people is not bad. You know, I'll give them that.
Oh yeah, okay. So exactly. Adam Beck is a conservative, and he becomes elected. He is elected as part of a government headed by James P. Whitney, a conservative government, that partly because they feel this public pressure, they end up supporting the public option for Niagara Falls.
If the public wants it, better go for it.
Exactly. And so I think it's in 1910, finally, the first circuit is attached, and it's hard for us to imagine how excited people were back then by the idea of public ownership and electricity. So electricity was coming to what we call Kitchener now. It was then called Berlin. Mm-hmm. And thousands of people, not only within the town of Berlin, but from the entire area, descend on Berlin for this exciting moment, and the premier's there, Adam Beck is there, and all kinds of officials, and they wait for the moment where Adam Beck presses the button, and nobody knows, will the lights really go on? Is it really powerful? Is it really possible?
They ran a risk.
And you know what? The lights go on. And it's just thrilling. People are dancing in the streets all night because for the first time...
Yeah, it's dark and the lights are on.
It's dark, but it's
phenomenal.
Not dark. It's
but you tell the story that he went then... He became like a public hero, and everybody wanted to see him.
Yes.
Yeah. They wanted him to come to their town and turn the power on.
And in fact,
when he came, they had a piece of Handel's music.
Well,
they sang it.
Yeah, it is true. He was treated as a hero in all these places where he went and turned the power on.
What is the song?
I think it's Hail.
See the conquering hero.
See the conquering hero comes.
Fantastic.
Do you have it by any chance?
But we do have it, actually. Let's play a bit of it.
Thank you.
Handel, hail the sea, the conquering hero, comes. We're talking to Linda McQuaig. Her book is The Sport and Prey of Capitalists. That's poor us. There's a goose falling from the sky, by the way. That would be the one that laid the American egg. Linda is with us. And Linda, you said, I mean, let's drive this point home. He was, people stood up, you said, more than once to sing that to him.
Yeah. I think it just, that's a story. And frankly, there's other stories of other people like him in the book, that he's a story of a great founder, creator, instigator of public enterprises.
And he had to fight. He had his enemies.
Henry Palace, or whatever his name is. The most powerful financial interests in the country against him. But our history is dotted with some very interesting stories where popular movements and great founders of public enterprise like Adam Beck had to fight these powerful financial interests. We don't know these stories anymore.
We don't at all. And your book is, this is great history. And you've cited a number of people who've been fighting to make this better known. I think it's going to become known. This, because we seem to be engaged with this fight again. We're in a curious kind of doldrum here. We have, in Britain, we have Mr. Corbyn reciting Shelley, and everybody loving it. We are many, they are few.
Yes, and then
we have Mr. Sanders, of all places, the United States, saying he's a socialist. And here he is, the candidate, with a good shot, at least a highly disturbing presence. Meanwhile, though, here the current, I'd say, is rather weak, but I suppose the storm will move into our zone at an appropriate time. But it's always a battle. What you describe, there are always the dark forces, and then there are the ones with the light. Talk about this, the CN Railway and CPR, the battle there, where again it was public versus private, and also with terrible echoes in recent years, like Lac-Mégantic.
Oh, yeah.
Where, as a result of a great battle between who's going to be in charge of the railways.
Yeah. Let me just quickly respond to your point about Canada.
Yes.
You know, we don't seem to have those movements going on. I guess all I would say is, at least in this election, we're finally hearing from the NDP some kind of progressive ideas.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know that they're fully behind them and really pushing them, but the platform is very progressive.
That's a very good point. By the way, Linda has a Twitter account. Please go to that, because you've been reflecting this point. People are avoiding the platform. They want to talk about something else.
Yeah, yeah.
But the platform is very solid.
Yeah, yeah, which is encouraging.
Yeah.
For instance, the wealth tax, you know, just to mention one idea. But okay, so you want CNR. Yeah, I mean, the whole, okay.
Mr. Thornton, I think his name was.
Yeah, I mean, we all know the CPR story, right? Canadian Pacific Railroad. I mean, we know that, you know, the last spike, that iconic picture and everything. What we don't know, that's a private enterprise story, and it's, you know, treated as kind of a triumph of private enterprise, even though it was really coddled private enterprise subsidized by government. But what we don't know is the story about Canadian National Railways, CNR. And basically what that was at the end of the First World War, there was all these failing, mostly private railway lines that the government pulled together as a national railway line, and nobody, the CPR was very much against this because it wanted the monopoly for all the, you know, wanted to take over those railway lines and become the railway monopoly. Nobody thought the CNR could survive. They end up not only surviving, but thriving. And I tell the story again, Henry Thornton is kind of the Adam Beck character in this story. You know, not only does he turn this around, make this a very successful public enterprise, but he does some really innovative things. He introduces, kind of is the first to introduce radio on trains, which sound, you know, radio was a big, big deal back then. And he set it up so you could hear it traveling on a train across Canada. It was really thrilling to people. More importantly, out of that grows CNR, creates radio kind of broadcasting stations across the country, which are very important because at that point, the radio was all private, okay? Mm-hmm. And most of Canada, all that they got in radio was from the dominant American private air.
Sounds familiar.
You know, yeah. And so this CNR, these CNR stations became the beginning of a kind of Canadian voice. And eventually...
You mentioned that he had operas and the Toronto Hard House String Quartet.
Yes.
That jumped out at me when I read that.
No, it's true. The CNR becomes actually at these broadcast stations across the country. It's kind of a cultural awakening. It's quite impressive, and some of it ends up being copied by the American private railway networks. We were actually ahead of them, but importantly, what happens also is that in the early 30s, they kind of really get the point that if we don't do something about this this radio domination of the airwaves by the Americans, we're not going to have much of a country. So there's a royal commission, and they end up advocating.
And once again, some conservative voices said exactly what you're saying.
Yes. So the royal commission ends up advocating public ownership of the radio waves. You know, having a public national broadcaster, which is very and that's endorsed by the conservative government of R.B. Bennett in the early 30s. And he makes a wonderful statement where he talks about the importance of public ownership. This should never be, you know, left to the devices of the private sector. I'm getting the words wrong, but that's the gist of it.
Yes.
Again, very surprising.
No, this is your... When we talk about public, that's a broad notion, and voices come from many quarters, but they will find their way towards the idea, yes, we share this, it's ours,
absolutely.
It should be ours, and not some private guy like the Casa Loma guy or some American medical outfit. Let's quickly, I want to make sure we get this point in. You, in your latter chapter, you talk about an opportunity right now. General Motors, that's an American outfit, near as I can tell, has decided, well, okay, enough of this, and they closed the plant in Oshawa. And there are people, Canadian postal workers, of course, Unifor, but also Labour, and NDP candidates are saying, oh, listen, why can't we take that? Why can't that belong to us? Why? We get back to Mr. Beck, electrical. How about Mr. Beck's electrical vision? Let's apply it to cars. Could you talk about
that? Well, you're right. So GM announced they were closing their Oshawa plant last year, and that's going to throw 2,000 workers at least out of jobs. Our governments did nothing about it, even though Ontario and federal government invested more than $10 billion to bail out GM during the financial crisis of 2008. So
they didn't mind our money when we put it in their pockets.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, what has happened, though, is that a group of workers at that plant has been organizing to push the government to nationalize the plant. And their argument is, you know, rather than shut down this historic plant that was the center of the automotive industry in Canada, let's have government take it over and let's use it to create green production vehicles, green utility, I can get into the specifics of it, but basically turn it into a green production facility for turning out green energy vehicles, which we desperately need as part of a sort of Green New Deal.
Yes.
And the important point there is that that's back to public enterprise. That's what we need.
We need
to revive that.
Lynn McQuaig, I think that's an idea whose time has come. Thank you very much for the book. Thanks for the interview. The Sport and Prey of Capitalists, Lynn McQuaig, How the Rich Are Stealing Canada's Public Wealth. And again, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mick. We'll see everybody next week.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From Mona Vista to the Vancouver Island. From the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake waters. This land was
just made for you and me.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley.
This land was made for you and me.